I don't think I'm going to I'm not going to plan on, well, I'm trying to decide whether to post the audio publicly. I'll post it audio publicly, but temporarily, just so if any of you all want to listen to it again. But we're going to put this up here. So first off, how many of you found the old midterm? Okay.
It wasn't terribly hard.
Yeah, I was just curious if people, like, you know, it's like, yes, I was not trying to hide it. It's publicly accessible. In fact, if you probably did a Google search for it, you probably would have found it.
I think I found it before you had set up the page for this term. So it was like the only term that was there was the 2015 one.
Yeah, or the past ones. So if you look at the questions, some of these should sound like, well, that sounds like a reasonable question. Others can kind of go like, huh. So first off, which of these sound like, I'm not sure how I'd answer that?
Two.
Well, that's interesting. Okay, two. Any other ones that look kind of... What, number five? Yeah, we haven't. So in past classes, I've talked about, at this point in the semester, I've talked more about distributed shared memory. We haven't really talked much about distributed shared memory. Kind of dropped that. I think we'll talk a bit about it later. But frankly, it's kind of a dead topic. So the idea of distributed shared memory is to be able to have a process run across multiple hosts at the same time. You know, we did see at least one system that kind of tried to do that. But we haven't talked about it too much. Is that it's kind of a dead end. So that question doesn't really seem kind of so applicable to what we've talked about. But you know, one, two, three, four. Seven, you make up a question. I don't know if seven's so good. Sometimes it actually causes students more problems than it solves. Because spending time making up a question on the midterm can be tricky. And also, if you notice reading the, up here, it kind of says, try to write it as one essay. That tends to cause problems too. It's hard to organize as one big essay as opposed to three smaller ones. So I wasn't planning on doing those two things. But so given this, it's worth talking about first number two, since you thought that would have some problem. That one I think is relevant. So the idea there is just saying pick a file system, or actually pick two file systems that we discussed in class and say, what was it built to do? Because all of the distributed file systems we talked about had specific use cases, particular environments in which they were supposed to make sense.
I thought you were talking about like a specific environment variable called file system that...
No.
We might talk this at some time, okay?
Yeah, the things around it were weirding me out.
Yeah.
I thought it was like a specific topic for a specific operating system.
No.
Okay. All
right. Yeah. Is how do I specify that it's a variable and you substitute in? Interpolation syntax is kind of... I explain that. I'm just trying to think of what... I think if I used like angle brackets just and had it there, would that make it more sense? Or if I just said dollar file system equals two file systems that you've...
Like even if you had just said the first part itself is if you try and have it basically without like a blank, you just have it.
Oh, just have it. If I just had a blank
file systems, right?
If I just had blank, wrote in a blank, you know, like kind of like unscripted. Okay, fair enough. Okay, that seems more test standard. Okay. Okay, so. So what are some other questions do you think make sense based on what we've discussed this semester? Okay, so I'm going to start copying and pasting questions over here. And just so you know, I'm not playing with you. I have not finished making up the midterm. I prefer to do it is to talk to you all during the review and see what you all think should be on the test and adjust accordingly. Because the nature of this class is, well, I think actually in general for any class, there's what you think you're teaching and then there's what the students actually learn, and what you can test them on realistically is somewhere in between the two. So.
Well, number four seems to be very, it relates a lot to what we learned over the first half of the semester.
Which one?
The three challenges, the three strategies to increase scalability.
Right, okay. I'm just going to copy these over as we mention them. Oh, whoops. Notice I'm not really trying to keep the question secret. Why not?
There's no one answer.
Exactly. There's no one answer. It just doesn't really. So describe three strategies. So tell me some strategies. I'll tell you if like you're way off or things, but come on, what are some of the strategies we talked about?
Simplicity.
Increased scalability, simplicity.
Basically, some of the problems with the overcomplicated systems is when you got at too large of a scale, it just became too complex and it was too difficult to keep track of everything. And so a lot of the implementations that worked were simple designs.
That's true. Okay. If you can give specific examples, sure. Yeah. Yes, so simplicity.
Parallelism? Parallel processes?
So you want to increase parallelism.
Yeah.
Right. And so how do you increase parallelism? So when we say increase parallelism, what do we have to do to enable increased parallelism? What kills parallelism in any computation? Well, what's the classic way? So you have two things that are parallel. If you just run them at the same time and they have any shared state, how do you make sure the shared state doesn't get messed up?
You have to use locking.
You have to do some sort of locking. That's why, you know, you have chubby, that's why you have mutexes and semaphores and all those things. You know, you need some sort of locking mechanism. Do locking mechanisms speed up your computation?
No.
So to scale.
Separate their states.
Yeah, you have to do something so that you minimize coordination. So there's a term in parallel computation known as embarrassingly parallel. The things that scale, that really scale, are all essentially embarrassingly parallel, which means that they require little to no coordination. And if you look at all the algorithms nowadays that we can run in real parallel, you'll notice they're basically not coordinating at all, mostly. I mean, what's a model of computation we've seen which really reduces that to its bare minimum?
MapReduce.
Do the same thing to everything independently, and then combine the results. So the combine the results part is not embarrassingly parallel. That's not, that's actually very much serial. Well, not particularly serial, it depends on how you do it. Maybe you'll be able to gather it together in small batches and put it all together, but the main thing, but it's much, it requires much more coordination, but it's over much less data. If you've done the structured appropriately, the map operation. And that's why you can scale. So.
Did you say that separating memory into chunks? So very important.
So potentially, I mean, again, there's lots of ways to answer this sort of question. You know, describe three strategies to increase scalability and structure. I think, but the trick with this one is to give very concrete examples, rather than talking about it at a very high level. Oh, look, you know, yeah, if you do this, it'll make it better. It's like, well, where did it? Give me a system. So those answers each, and I could say. Now, one thing I could do to take that question a bit harder is to say, you gotta do it from three separate systems. You know, because one thing I don't necessarily want to say, oh, I figured out GFS, but I didn't learn anything else this semester. It's like, it's not quite what I want, looking for.
Would availability have an impact on scalability as well?
How so?
In the sense that if you have high availability of a given system, then it could definitely be scaled from, it could be scaled to a higher stage in that sense. Because if you have a system, let's say you're on a lower scale, let's say it's for a home network that you're running multiple systems or whatever it is, availability might not be a big concern, but if you're running it for a larger organization or something like that, then it would be a concern.
Well, so what does... what you're saying is when you have a large-scale computation, mm-hmm. availability is a factor.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say so much that if you had a system that hardware that was perfectly that was perfectly reliable, you wouldn't that wouldn't really matter. But you know. I wouldn't say it's so much an enabler, it's just that it's a reality you have to deal with, and if you try scaling too far, you have to deal with it one way or the other.
Okay.
The classic way of dealing with it is you just make the hardware more reliable. Okay, and how effective... What in the world? Did I type that? Okay. Okay. So, the file system one, so... So, so this Unix compatibility is sacrificed in order to improve scalability. We've seen that a few times, right? So, now, well, is it or isn't it? I'll say up to this point, we've seen mostly examples where they has been sacrificed. But if you look later on, they get back a lot. Some of the more recent systems that we'll look at later in the semester actually get back some of the semantics. Because I realize, oh, those were useful semantics. Some of them. So when you say Unix semantics, it's kind of a broad thing. I mean, we're still a lot of times accessing files and doing reads and doing, what is Unix semantics?
Unix semantics, do you consider it like, if you're working on a file, you can see other people working on the same file, that you treat it as one file.
Yeah. Well, what I'm saying, I'm saying that if you think of Unix semantics, it's easy to talk about the very corner case kind of things. Like, okay, what happens if two processes are writing to the same file? What happens? Well, in classic Unix, this is what happens. So our program should behave like this. But if you look at more generally, who relies on that? That's not most of the computation that you do. So actually mostly Unix semantics is preserved because we still do file opens and reads. Like things like NFS is mostly Unix. And even maybe, you look at the Google file system, they've kind of really done things different, but really is it that different from the semantics we're used to? How hard is it really to adapt a program to use that? I mean, competitive. Yeah, well, that's so. When I say this statement, you can argue potentially for or against it, depending on how you think of it. If you think of Unix compatibility as being all the little details of semantics, but you know, compare this to we've had some systems where they put everything as objects. Remember the one, you know, like, which was it? Hmm? Yeah, exactly. So everything's an object. We're going to have a thread running across all the things and stuff. It's like, did we build systems like that? No. So we didn't go for a really radically weird model of computation when we went to the cloud. We actually tried to keep things as close to kind of standard Unix-y semantics. Hasn't all been, I mean, things have been sacrificed. But actually, you know, you could argue that, well, actually, mostly it's been preserved as much as possible. It's, you know, and in fact, sometimes even in the face of a big, even when it limits scalability, a lot of it's preserved because it's so useful, and that's the way programmers think about problems. You know, as opposed to other weird models of computation.
Would the portability of applications also factor into that?
Potentially. Saying like, you know, if you people want to run, you know, standard code on here. So you can sacrifice some, but if you really destroy the computational model, then you have to throw out all your code.
I mean, if you consider like people actually using the system as part of your scaling, then I guess Unix would be crucial.
Yeah. And you could also say things like GFS are a corner case. And in fact, many of the other systems have tried to give much more, you know, better Unix, you know, like semantics and stuff. You know, even Chubby is kind of, you know, a little Unix-y. This will be a more fun question for the final exam.
So is there argument against it then?
Hmm?
Is there an argument the other way then? Saying that
well, I was saying it hasn't been sacrificed. That's what I was saying. It hasn't been sacrificed because we've actually kept most of Unix semantics. We haven't gone to some really bizarro computational model. We still are doing things that are, you know, while the details may not be exactly what Unix is, in broad strokes, it's still roughly the same computational model. So even if you have to tweak your code, you don't have to think of a completely different way of architecting your solution. So that's what I mean by compatibility. It's like, it's been sacrificed in some ways, in other ways it hasn't been sacrificed. So this is kind of a classic. Depends on how you want to frame it. If it's 70%, you know, Unix compatible, did you sacrifice 30 or did you keep 70? So, classic essay. And so in case you haven't noticed, one of the things I'm really gonna be looking for in you writing these things is you making a good argument. I'm not looking for you just to have memorized everything. I'm looking for you to have, you know, lay out your points.
Should we be writing making known systems?
Yes. But you should still make very concrete references. You don't need to explain all the semantics of them, but you should explain enough to show that, you know, it's like. So it's easy to make a reference of just saying, oh, look, you know, GFS illustrates this. And go like, well, why does GFS illustrate this? And so in order to do that, you're going to have to explain the details. You don't have to start at the top and say, well, GFS is a file system that does this, and they have this character. It's like, no, don't do that. But do Does that help?
Yep.
Okay. So, okay. Oh, just a caveat. I'm just listing these questions as possible questions, especially if you know them. I'm not saying that these are going to be the questions because I'm going to sit down and think about it. Just want to give that caveat. So, okay. So let's rather than keep going through these questions, let's talk about, let's go back to the this is not a bad keyboard. It's a Microsoft one, but I don't know what model. Anyway, so look at these readings. What I like to ask are questions that force you to integrate ideas from across the things we've thought about this semester. Because it should be a learning experience writing the midterm, right? And studying for it. So particularly, let's think about some of the early stuff. What questions come to mind regarding those? Here's one. Resource sharing. To what extent is to what extent do we resource share with modern, distributed, with modern systems we've talked about in class? How much of what we do is actually resource sharing? What, and in what context?
Sharing files.
Well, so what were the use cases they really talked about with resource sharing?
Sort of scientific computation.
It's like, here's my computer, you can run jobs on it. Right? It's like, okay, here you can, dial in, you can run programs on my system. And we can send files to each other. Right? That was, that's kind of the thing of resource sharing with other things. We can share data, and then you can run your programs on my system. You can remotely log in and do that. Is that what we do today with the internet? Well,
kind of do it, but like the company would provide what resource we want. We don't give our systems, it's more like we use a company that provides the service to us. So like we use Facebook for sharing of videos and.
Yeah, but Facebook offloads all the computation of its UI onto your machine.
But it still does do some of the computation itself.
Yes, it does plenty of computation itself.
Yeah.
So when you use Facebook, you are getting access to their computers, the computation, and you're doing some computer locally. It is providing certainly lots of storage for you and giving you remote access to that storage. Certainly there's communication. The question is to what extent is what we do today, to what extent does what we do today fit into the vision that they had in the early 70s? I mean, is it really the same thing, except just fancier? Or is it different?
I would say it's a little bit fancier, if anything, because if you think about, like, for instance, like, like Amazon EC2, where they have those compute servers, that everything is really distributed and they will do whatever computations you need for accessing cloud services and things like that. It's similar to how it would be like, okay, I need to offload a job and I'll offload it to a given client and I'll be able to still have the resources on my machine, but it's now being offloaded to another machine to do whatever I need it to do and then come back to me with whatever data I need.
Right, but is that fundamentally different from submitting a job remotely, having it run, and then having the results be sent back to you as a file? I mean, this is, so I'm thinking in terms of the actual, not so much the fancy application, oh, we're doing, you know, Instagram, or, you know, we're doing all these other things on top, but what does the computation look like? And the way, you know, is it really the same thing, or is it really kind of, the is there something different about what we do other than scale? Certainly scale is bigger.
Also, it's just the only main thing has changed that, like, obviously each person has access to a significantly more powerful machine,
yeah,
just in their own personal computer. So, like,
right,
when you access something, they can still give you, like, they can still give you things to do work yourself without you being dependent. Like, you can still do quite a bit of the work yourself with still doing, getting things from other people. It's just that sort of, like.
So I would argue, is the resource sharing, resources are shared, but what's the nature of the resource is a bit different. Because why am I running computation over at Facebook rather than on my machine? It's not necessarily that my machine does not have the computational power to do that. It's more that, well, first off, it's, you know, they're it's being accessed, you're getting access to a lot more data. But also it's about putting it, it's really mostly putting about somewhere where other people can access it. I mean, I would often thought about what if you structured something like Facebook just like a personal web server. You know, my news feed is just on my website. I mean, it's just a blog, kind of, I mean, when I say a blog, but I mean, provide the full Facebook interface. People would come onto it and could post comments and things. And then to share things on other people's walls or other things like that would just be everyone has their own systems and we just have a standard protocol for allowing things to go in and then maybe some way of doing authentication. But the authentication would be, you know, who are my friends? My friends are the ones who are, you know, who have access to my, who can post comments on my page and do things and who let me post comments on their page. You know, it's kind of funny that we have these centralized services for this because actually we could potentially do all this stuff in a completely decentralized fashion. We just don't. Search is a bit harder. But social networking? I don't think we really get much from it. Except that all our computers are always being turned off. So you have to have you'd have to have a server that's yours that's always up.
Just for you.
Yeah. But why not?
Because then it all becomes all about you.
What do you mean? Well, that's what you kind of have already with Facebook.
Except it's like a free account that you make.
I mean, a free account that you make versus a server that you run for yourself.
I don't know. That seems
it's
like
just,
you're making a monument to yourself, you know?
No, I mean, it's just a web page. And it doesn't have to, I mean, it doesn't have to be all in one system. You could have some shared state or something. Like maybe your family would have its own. You know, or still with all the shared hosting and everything, you can consolidate it all together.
I mean, there is Mastodon. It's a distributed version of Twitter. It's open source.
Yeah.
It's doable.
I mean, you have to have everyone willing to take part, provide some amount of computational resources towards this, but actually the process of distributing the computation and storage. I mean, most of these things are not, like Google search is actually different in the sense of the index they have, it really reaches across so many systems. Building up a distributed index that really works is that's a bit of a hard CS problem. I don't think it's necessarily unsolvable. But things like what Facebook does is actually not, it's embarrassingly parallel, mostly. The amount of coordination required is actually really small, relatively speaking, and scales very nicely. Because, I mean, well, at least as long as you're talking about individuals who have, you know, order 1,000 friends. You know, if you start talking about celebrities or someone who have much larger presences or something, that's different. But then you can implement the equivalent of content distribution networks and stuff and replicate. That's how it's built anyway. And I'll kind of try to capture that question, see. Resource sharing computer communication networks. How are they same? How are they different? I'll just save this page. Do a commit. Oh, that's really annoying. Okay, fine. Guess lines are a little. So, what else? What else did we talk about? Mother of all demos. How do the systems we've talked about afterwards really connect with the mother of all demos? I mean, well, there's the Alto, but after the Alto. How do these fit into Doug Engelbart's vision? Do they? Collaboration.
I think the usability of Unix kind of fed off that initial vision.
Yeah, in some ways. I mean, what were the tasks that, you know, Doug Engelbart envisioned people doing?
Word processing, simple video chat.
Hypertext.
Grocery
list. Yeah. But, you know, hypertext. That was a key part of what he was talking about. How much of the later stuff, I think the real change you could argue with the systems that you will see is that the newer systems are all designed in some sense to support hypertext. It's the, you know, everything Google does in some sense is the infrastructure for large scale hypertext. maybe we haven't seen that really play out quite as much yet, because we're only kind of midway through the story. We still have. We're going to be talking all about, you know, Amazon's and Facebook's infrastructure. And
I would say a lot of what we looked at kind of drift away from what the mother of all demos do, because really, like, he talks about more of the human aspect, and I feel like a lot of the systems we looked at between them are more of the technical aspect of how we can get systems to communicate, and, like, the usability of how people would use them together is more of an afterthought, except for maybe, like, GFS and some more recent stuff, but a lot of the ones in the middle are kind of just, hey, this is cool, let's build it, but
right.
Less how do people use it together.
Right. And which I think is very telling for, like, especially the earlier systems. Things like, you know, NFS and AFS, you know, Amoeba and all those things, were they designed with a Doug Engelbart kind of view of the world? Not really. They were designed for basically taking the little kind of, you know, workstation people were working on and think, oh, let me make it bigger. But then when real scale came, post-web, and people wanted to, like, really build these large systems, they had to start thinking back, okay, how do we support this vision in a large, large scale? And that's when the real, I'd argue that's when the real distributed computation, distributed operating system really had to start being built. So again, I think that will make more sense at the end of the semester, after we've kind of had another month of discussing things. I think we'll see a lot. We will see a lot more things along those lines. But yeah, that's a thread we haven't really picked up on so much. But I think it very much does fit in. But that's something interesting to think about. Does the work we discussed in class follow? That seems a little broad. I probably want to narrow that as an actual. good old NFS or Amoeba or something. How did those systems look to you now? Like those. This. To what extent did early efforts in So what do you think of that question?
They
all, they ran. So in some sense, they were, you know, what is success? You know, part of this is, what does success and failure mean? What do we mean by success? What do we mean by failure? Some of these systems were used for many years.
They defined what worked and what didn't work, I guess.
Or just trying to, just like, in what way did they achieve their original, like, goals that they were trying to design? Because, like, even if some of the goals became outdated, it's still, like, it's a success if you designed what you were trying to design.
Yeah. Well, let's say it depends on how you want to define it. You could say, okay, that's it. Now, one way to define success here is saying, is this work that led to modern systems? Is this part of a succession? Like, for example, you look in the microprocessor business. You know, the big successes have been ARM and Intel chips, you know, architectures. That's what's really become to dominate the market. It's not that other ones don't exist in the market or anything, but they're all much more niche players. The big systems are all running on these two microprocessor families. So why did, so those succeeded, long term, and the other ones have largely failed. Why? So similarly, if you look at the various technical currents in building things that you're operating, there's certain things that really did not continue. We don't build things like that. Well, other ones, we really do build like this, or we had to develop new ways of doing it. I'm not even saying that we've definitely settled down on how to build these things, but we certainly know there's certain ways you don't do some of these things. And it really comes down, how are we going to scale the infrastructure to run larger scale computations and things with storage? And a lot of those early efforts didn't. So, why didn't they?
There was a lot of, reliance on having the same or similar hardware as opposed to, like, GFS, which can run on anything in DOS. Like, a lot of the other ones were pretty much just tying the same workstations together.
So there was uniformity. You know, there's uniformity in there.
Security,
well. A lot of current systems don't take account for security, depending upon, I mean, it depends what, security you have to take into account if you have untrusted individuals using it. But I'm thinking just in terms of scalability. Possible, but like the things we talk about inside major internet companies, those are still right now largely trusted infrastructures. Regular users do not have access at the level, and so the security is that they just don't get deep enough. Any system that does have deep enough access typically can mess with it pretty freely. Of course, they don't tell you exactly all the protections they built in, so I'm sure there's some things, but given that those things aren't really tested, I'm sure that it's pretty wide open, even today. At least there are ways to make it wide open, even if there's maybe some pro forma access controls. Because that's a fact in security. Only things that you can really trust is keeping things out of things that have actually been subject to stress. But more, I would argue that it's the question of goals. Scalability wasn't their first goal. Their goal was, let me scale it and get X, Y, and Z. Like, let me get scale and let me have Unix compatibility. Oh, I want to run this. I mean, it's all about relative to the stuff they have. Let me try making use of a few more systems. It wasn't, okay, I need to scale like nobody's business and everything else comes secondary. And that's the real difference. When you get to the system, it's like, okay, we have other design goals, there's other things we'd like, but the first thing we have to be able to do is scale, and everything else doesn't matter. These systems were not built first. Scalability was not the first thing. I mean, they did consider that, but they said, we also want this, this, and this, and we're willing to make some compromises in order to get those other things, because they wanted it to work the way they wanted it to work. Once they started really trying to scale, then that's when they started trying crazy things. We never really talked about it. Well, you all talked about Farsight. I wasn't there. Another dead end. So I certainly talked about, there is a lot of similarity between Ocean Store and Farsight. There's also a lot of difference. So how about just compare and contrast. Key similarities and key differences. I always like Plan 9. People when they look at Plan 9, they go like, "Oh, that's so cool. Why aren't we using that?"
Because it's not what it's.
It's solving a problem that we really didn't have. And it did so in a way that was its own special snowflake. So that's interesting. That's a question we ask. Why is my mouse not letting me do that? There we go. It's not typing. It's like. Lots of different ways of answering that.
I mean, simple one is Unix was first, right?
No.
It was good enough. Why change something?
Specific. Technology, context, or both. I mean, keep in mind, when did, you know, look at the time of Plan 9. When was it being developed? I mean, 1991. When did Linux come out? No, Linux. First version of Linux, I believe, is 93. Actually, I'm curious about that. When is the first Linux?
1991.
Okay, 91. Okay.
Version 1 was released in 94. The first prototypes were in 91.
So, I mean, this undergrad in Finland was writing in a little operating system, and the folks at Bell Labs were writing an operating system who, oh, by the way, wrote, you know, Unix. Somehow one won, the other one didn't. And which one? And it's not the one you probably would have bet on at the time. I think I'd want to more narrowly scope that in order to make it a good question. Right now, that's a very, very broad scope of a question. But you get the issue is that what's up with Plan 9 kind of seems like Unix done right. So nice and clean. I mean, Unix actually taking into account networking. But it's also wrong. Or, you know, what that means. Go back here. Other questions from here. Other things? I mean, we can sit here and talk about papers specifically, but I'm just, what are things that didn't make sense or papers? I mean, we can talk about details of specific papers that you look back and go, like, I don't know what this paper is doing. Unix is a pretty bad name, too. Oh. Think of it this way. So one problem with Plan 9 was licensing. Right? There was definitely a problem with licensing with Plan 9 in terms of Bell didn't want to just give it away and open source it initially like they did. I mean, it took them many years until well after other open source operating systems were well entrenched before it became open source. But they were publishing these ideas. And the paper was in 91 that described the basic Plan 9. So people could have taken that and built their own version. There's nothing fundamental. They could have built their own network protocol or anything like that. I mean, it wouldn't, may not have been exactly Plan 9, but just like so many things aren't exactly Unix, it could have been very much Plan 9-like, and we'd still follow the same design principles. And even, you know, maybe even be binary be compatible in various ways. But that's not what happened. Some features did get pulled over. The proc file system for Linux came from Plan 9. But what about the rest? I mean, the Linux kernel's goal, what they were really trying to do, was build something that was POSIX compatible. POSIX was the standard. I mean, remember, Unix had been fragmented over the 80s. And so they came up with this standardization of what Unix was. So what was the design, when Linus Torvalds was, you know, was directing the building of the Linux kernel, it was to support POSIX applications. That was the goal. And they had lots and lots of POSIX compatible software with which they wanted to port and run on their system. Doing a clean slate design, which kind of was there, but wasn't really prioritizing making the software work, was like, who cares? I mean, there are already, you know, millions of systems running Unix. They wanted to use the software that was running on them. Remember, one of the design goals of Plan 9 was not to preserve Unix compatibility. They wanted to do things right. I mean, a lot of things were basically Unix compatible, but other things weren't. Like, for example, the whole 9P protocol of trying to bind together systems, that was its own special snowflake. There was just its own idea of how to connect things together. And what came in 94 as the way to bind systems together? Well, 93. That's when the web came out. Because remember, when we wanted to bind things together, what actually we were playing with all these protocols were things that would work across multiple systems, that would work in the context of the internet. It was a protocol that was general, that could be run on many different kinds of systems. Plan 9 talked to Plan 9. It was a great protocol, but it wasn't to talk to anyone else. I mean, they had this worm thing and but that was just, they had that hardware and they made it kind of work nicely for it, but their design wasn't fundamental to that. Could have had something very Plan 9-like without that. In fact, that's what we do have in the virtual machines that run Plan 9. They don't require you to have a worm jukebox. We've been going for about an hour. I'm happy to go for a bit longer, but I think I'll have you do three or four, depending on how tightly I focus it. But you'll have 80 minutes to write your midterm. You'll have a choice of questions.
Do you think you'll include the first one as well?
Hmm?
Do you think you'll include the first question as well?
What do you think of it?
It's a good question. It was actually, I believe, one of the first questions that you brought up when we started the semester.
I'm just gonna say. Okay, I'll say. I'll just say. Anything from winter 2015 midterm. Oh, what do you think of that question? Yeah, so what's good about it is it's general. What's bad about it is it's general. I think I'm going to try making the questions a little more pointed.
Do you think you'll have one question that's mandatory?
I don't know. I'm trying to think of something specifically that I would include that was mandatory, and right now it's not coming to my mind. I mean, if I conclude something like, what's the truth? Okay.
Like, should we be talking about, is the internet a distributed operating system? Should we lean into that, or should we lean into something that we've already talked about, like the scale up to the internet?
I think that question works a little better in the final exam, given the way we've talked about things. I think there's some more pieces, parts of it. I don't think we've addressed enough to really talk about it that well. That's the only reason I'm hesitant about it.
I mean, the second part of the question is kind of hard to answer with what we've looked at, because we haven't seen any modern distributed operating system.
And the only thing we've seen is the Google stuff, which is just the beginning of it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more stuff to cover.
And like more of a file system or specific key and less of an operating system, right?
Right.
I mean, if we were to argue right now, we'd probably all have to say there is no operating system at internet scale, right? There's distributed systems, but not, I guess, classic operating.
Well, I the argument I always give about whether an internet operating system exists today is that in the classic, the full range of classic functions that an operating system doesn't exist at distributed scale. We do pieces, parts as we need it. But part of that is because what we really want at the internet scale for a distributed operating system has one fundamental requirement that's different from individual systems, that we cannot have a centralized dictatorship for the internet. It has to be a distributed administrative control over the systems. And so how do we have distributed administrative control while still allowing for resources? I mean, we are doing this to some degree. It's just all pieces, parts. It's like you can do single sign-on, kind of, but it's not one way of doing it. There's like 10 ways of doing it, each of whom has some fraction of the authority. But it's like, why, if I'm looking, why can I not just have a central, this is who I am, and, you identify it. Well, there's all these different standards and they all have different levels of control and security and whatever. But then even for authorizing things, like what resources should you have access to? We haven't figured out we can't figure out how to identify people in a unified way or systems. The closest we have is IP addresses, but that really doesn't really identify them. This is how you reach them. I would say that I've talked about in a previous run of the class, we spent some time thinking about this, and at the end of the day, it starts looking like politics. It's like, what would it mean for computers to govern themselves in a distributed fashion? Because it's really about power. Who tells you what to do with the computation in your storage? Once you realize that's the central question, then you go like, well, how do you actually do that? I'm not going to ask you about that. We haven't really been talking about that, but. I mean, but that's the way we build all our systems, though. There certainly is a god of Google. Yeah. It's probably not one person, but I'm sure there's a small group of people who could probably shut down every server at Google if they wanted to. millions of computers. You know, that's a little bit of a funny thing to think about and realize, you know, same thing at Facebook. There's probably a small number of people who could, you know, format the entire infrastructure of Facebook. Because and we know that and we know this is the case. We know it has to exist, because otherwise, how would they update their software? If you can update the software, you can destroy it. And we know they update their software all the time. So how does that fit into a governance situation is a whole other question. Anyway, I think we can, unless you all have more questions. Out of curiosity, are any of you planning on doing the paper as well? The paper is a lot more work. I mean, you gotta spend some time reading the papers and studying, but then, you know, it takes some work to write the exam, but it's not as much as writing a paper. But I've actually found a number in past years, definitely a number of undergrads have kind of gone like, well, you know, I really want to do well, and so I get nervous with tests, so I'll write the paper. Which is fine.
Just my heart beating, my fourth year engineering project, and enough research for the paper.
No, exactly. Grad students are supposed to have enough time and are supposed to be, you know, grad students are not supposed to be taking 4 or 5 courses a term. They're only supposed to take at most 2. Maybe 3, they're pushing it, and that's considered very busy, and they're supposed to spend time doing things like writing papers. So I find it's kind of a nice way of kind of having the experience in the class. I think it's useful for people to talk about things and stuff, and then how do you differentiate between... I think you all are participating just as well as the grad students in the discussions, but in terms of how do you make it also a grad course, it's like, well, do a project. That's a whole other, yeah, a lot of work. Cool.
Do people usually do pretty well with exams?
Depends. So, what's my? That's a reasonable question. What's my grading criteria? What am I looking for? I normally grade these questions in. So some portion of the question is just, yeah, the great. So I grade each one and kind of give it a score for these parts. And one is this reasonably written? You know, what would I grade the quality of this in terms of just the writing? You know, is it well organized? Are you laying things out? Are you doing that? So that's related to how well you can write. You gotta be able to put your thoughts together. Another portion is technical quality. Is it clear that you understand what you're talking about and the papers and things and stuff? And then, you know, the third portion is, are you making a valid, how's your argument? You know, so it's very possible to have something that, you know, very nice sentence structure, very nice kind of like flows and everything, and goes in and has lots of references that individually are very correct, and is utter crap.
Is that enough to pass? Is that enough to pass?
So, what's the weighting of those things? I would normally do it like half on the technical argument and a quarter and quarter for the other two parts. Because I don't want you to submit just to write a well-written essay which doesn't even answer the question. You know, according to that grading criteria, that's what it'd be. So I'm generally pretty I might grade grade each question out of 8 or something, 2 points for organization, writing, 2 points for general technical quality, and 4 points for argument. Oh, actually, maybe like, I think I may have done 2, 3, 3. Because actually, technical quality models too. So if you do that, then how many points is it total? Is it 25 points? 25%? So if I do it for, yeah, if I do it for 3 questions and 8, then that's like 24 points. So that's close. So 25. Doesn't evenly divide by 3. Doesn't evenly divide by 4.
Just give us 1%.
You showed up. Yeah, 1% question. What is your name?
What is your name? What is your favorite color? I'll have to think about that. I've got to have a 1-point question I like. Okay. So that's it. I will turn off the recording.